Hey friends, and welcome back to Open Arted Podcast. I'm your host, Monica, and in this podcast, we explore why making art is more practical than you might think. In today's conversation, I will talk with a pianist and educator, Josh Wright, who is a founder of the Pro Practice Piano Academy. It contains around 500 video lessons about the art of playing piano. I was really curious to talk to Josh as I discovered him on YouTube sharing useful insights about piano technique and different aspects of being a musician. On this episode, we talked about what inspires him, how he structures his work, how to break the unnecessary classical musician's ego, and also Josh explained how he changed his mindset about what it means to have a career in the classical music field. Just before we jump into today's conversation, I'd like to say a big thank you to everyone who supports us on Patreon. This podcast is powered by the global piano community Piano Buffs, which we are building together with my husband Robert. We create fun piano music videos with light effects and other interesting statistics so more people could enjoy the beauty of piano music. By joining our Patreon family, you will not only contribute to the production of this podcast and Piano Buffs, but you will also gain access to our monthly video episodes, which we create together with Robert. You can find more information about this in the podcast description. And now, without further ado, let's dive into today's conversation. Feels like you kind of went this very traditional, but in a good way, traditional way of, you know, developing your career. You went to great schools, you had great teachers, then you did a lot of competitions, and now a lot of your work is on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And I find it really interesting because I think many of us, especially in this age where I am now, you know, finishing the school and kind of just realizing what to do. What was your thought process? Because I think for you, YouTube came quite naturally. You've been doing it since forever and for totally different reasons, right? And it kind of like just floated in. So maybe you could share a little bit about this journey, how it all unfolded and how does it feel now?
Sure. So I used YouTube to upload a few performance videos first. I can't remember if that was for a specific purpose or just to share them for competition recordings that I had already made. But then I was teaching a lot. I've taught quite a bit since I was 16 years old as a way to earn money and also as a way to develop as a musician. I ask all of my teenage students to try to find at least one student to teach. Even if they're a brand new beginner or they're an adult or they're a little child, because you develop so much understanding of your own skills and you learn to think differently when you have to show it to someone else. So I started the YouTube tutorials. I think it was the first two. I can't remember which one was first. It was organized practice, and the second one was accuracy, and I divided them up into several parts, mostly so I could have a reference tool for my students, because I was noticing, as we all do as teachers, repeating myself in lessons a lot. You know, I would tell one student one thing, and then the very next lesson, I would say, oh, I was just teaching this to the previous student. So I thought, this is not as efficient as it could be. It would be nice to quickly explain something in a lesson, but then do a deeper dive with a 10 or 20 or 30 minute video that they could watch outside of the lesson. And it was also very good for lesson preparation. So if a student sent me a text and said, I'm really struggling with accuracy on this passage, I could say, go watch this video and then we'll look at it in your lesson. And they already received a lot of my ideas from the video. And then we could be more efficient in the lesson. That's proved very helpful. So I enjoyed doing it as just a teaching aid for my own students. But quickly after I started posting those videos, at the end of the video, I said, if anyone has any questions, here's my email address. And I started within maybe a week or two getting requests from people around the world. Somebody in Switzerland, I think Claudio or something. And I have that video for his two little girls. That was probably my third or fourth video, something like that. I don't remember if that's the correct name, but it started to open up my eyes to, wow, this could be really great. And then I kind of let there be a little bit of a lull. I would only post every few months. And it was in probably 2012 or 13 that I had so much traction from the channel and so much demand for that, that I said, you know, I need to take this more seriously. I need to post on a more consistent schedule. So I started trying to do that amid my master's and doctoral studies. And then in 2014, I launched my paid course, which is called Pro Practice, which it was an idea from one of my students. He said, you know, I would love to pay you to take me through all of Clair de Lune or all of another piece, just maybe a 1 hour tutorial. You know, it doesn't have to be 5 hours, but it's not your little 10 or 20 minute YouTube tutorials. I really want to see that in depth. I would pay for that. And I thought, okay, let's try this and let's actually give it a nice splash to begin with. So I uploaded, I think it was 20 videos in 20 days or something. And I did a lot of prep work before that. And I used repertoire that I'd worked on for a long time, that I was very familiar with, mostly. I think there was a couple newer pieces in there. But I've never had that type of upload schedule since I started. I can't do a tutorial a day on a major piece. That was quite difficult. So now I try to do one or two pro practice tutorials a month. The library is, it's hard to tell the exact number because I don't count all the time, but in the pro practice library, there's over 500 videos. And I think about 100 of those are a collaboration project between me and my Chinese friend who does all of my translating into Chinese with Chinese subtitles on those. That's been a fun side project. So there's around 400 of those pro practice tutorials now. And it's been just so rewarding to hear people's requests. I still do the free YouTube tutorials and I get ideas for those from my audience. They write in requests of things they'd like to see. So it's been a really fun project, something I never thought would be this big, and I never thought it would be the main source of my income. I think that transition came about maybe 4 or 5 years ago, where I started to earn more from my paid courses than I did from private teaching and concerts, which was mind-boggling to me, but it's been really fun. So since then, I've taken these courses even more seriously. I was already taking them very seriously, but now I'm always thinking, what's my next tutorial? I need to start practicing that piece if I'm not currently playing it. Because if I play an hour of new repertoire a year, which is I try to do, you know, 40 to 60 minutes of new rep every year, which, as you know, is a very demanding schedule. Just even
it's crazy.
If you're just, yeah, even if you're just working as a pianist, not doing all this other stuff. But I try to sprinkle that with easier tutorials as well, because we have a big community of beginner and intermediate pianists in the course too. So for instance, right now I'm working on the Waldstein Sonata. That's been one of the most highly requested tutorials. Beethoven Sonata in C major, number 21, opus 53, nicknamed the Waldstein Sonata. And I've learned it in like the last 4 or 5 weeks, just the first movement. I have to play it for a little miniature concert this Sunday. And I took it to my teacher because for the advanced repertoire, I always like to play for my wife and play for my teacher, Susan Duhlmeier. I've studied with her for over 20 years and I'll just play it for both of them to get further ideas because they're both so brilliant. And while I'm working on that, she said, oh, are you recording this next week? And I said, no, this tutorial needs a little bit more care and polishing because it's one of the most famous pieces in the piano repertoire. And it's very difficult. The piece is very difficult. So I have to be kind of a master of pacing myself of, okay, here's a free YouTube video. Here's an easier tutorial. Here's kind of an intermediate tutorial. Now I'm ready with my advanced tutorial. And it's just always churning in my mind. But it's very rewarding. I enjoy doing it a lot, and it keeps me motivated, knowing what people want and seeing if I can fulfill those requests.
And how do you handle this, you know, crazy multitasking? In a way, you could say that you don't multitask because all your job is around music. But on the other hand, because I feel like I can really relate and I know how you feel, I think it's very difficult to find quality time for practicing, you know, because all this posting on Instagram and making videos, it's really time consuming. And I assume you also think about the future videos, what you will do. So you have, you know, you cannot work day by day. You have to like plan it out. And there's so much work behind that. So how do you structure that?
Yeah, it is. It's been a process to figure out my rhythm and my pace. So I try to do at the maximum every other week a pro practice tutorial. And then I will on those off weeks, I will do a free YouTube video. And I've covered so many topics now on YouTube that a lot of these topics that we're covering now are more philosophical. So they don't take insane amounts of work. So last week was 2 tips to avoid burnout and discouragement. Some of the previous videos before that were, you know, 10 tips when returning to piano, because that's been a really hot topic people have asked me about that I never really covered. So there are still some technical discoveries that I'll make that I'll share in little YouTube videos, or, hey, I was teaching this piece and I just noticed if I rotate my hand this way, or if I choose this fingering, or if I think about it and organize it differently, that those make for quick, good videos. And people actually probably like the free stuff as much as they do the paid stuff, because I have a humongous audience for the free stuff and a much smaller audience for the paid courses, but it's rewarding nonetheless. So I, for instance, for this year, I have planned out, and this, nobody can hold me to this because stuff changes according to concerts. And if someone called me and said, we want you to play Prokofiev Third Piano Concerto, I'd drop all my stuff and start working on that, right? But tentatively, I have some bigger pieces this year, the Waldstein Sonata, Mendelssohn's Serious Variations, which I played many years ago, but that's going to take some work to bring back, and Ravel Sonatine, and then some more intermediate tutorials. I've already covered a couple so far this year, like June by Tchaikovsky from The Seasons. I did this little fantasy dance by Schumann. I'll be doing Traumerei next week by Schumann, and Brahms Rhapsody, Opus 79, number 2. And then I can sprinkle in some really much more simple tutorials after that, such as something from the notebook for Anna Magdalena Bach or other beginner tutorials. So I start with my big projects like Ravel Sonatine. That's brand new. Never played it. Beethoven Waldstein. Never played it. And out of those two, I know that the Waldstein will challenge me personally more. I feel like I play Ravel better than I do Beethoven. So I say, I got to start working on the Beethoven first. And so that's what I'm at right now. And it's a little panicky at the beginning of the year because you're like, oh my gosh, like I have so much work ahead of me. But I put the hardest things first. So even I might record those Beethoven tutorials. I don't know. I'm thinking maybe I'll record them in May or June, but maybe it'll be in December. I don't know. But it will be done before the end of the year. Because once that starts to get into a polishing phase, I will start working on the Sonatine and perhaps use the Mendelssohn Serious Variations, which I know will come back quickly. It'll take a bit of work, but since I played that before, that'll come back fairly quickly. I have to pace the hard things like that, and then I sprinkle in the intermediate stuff. So the intermediate stuff I'll prepare usually a couple of weeks. For the beginner tutorials, I might prepare for a few days or a week just to make sure that I do my research and I'm not sounding like a moron in these tutorials. As I've gained more followers, I felt more pressure to be more polished in all of my videos. So it is a lot of pressure, but that's how I pace those things. And like you said, when do you find time to practice? I usually am practicing once my kids are in bed. So like 9 p.m. to midnight is usually when I'm practicing. Or I'll try to sneak some practice in during when my son is napping, because this room's fairly soundproof. So yeah, that's it. You have to get creative.
That's another struggle, you know, when you have a family. When you don't have kids, it's all time is yours.
And yes. Then,
right?
Yeah, you have to be really creative. But it's been very interesting at various points in my life. I noticed that a lot of times when I'm the very busiest, I'm the most effective and efficient because you have to think about efficiency. You have to think, okay, and it's when you have all the time in the world that it's easy to slack off and not actually get things done. So even though people would say, oh, having kids can be so limiting to a music career, it's motivated me personally to be more efficient, still spend a lot of time with my kids and my wife and still be successful as a musician doing this. I've definitely cut back a lot on my private teaching. I maybe teach 10 lessons a week now. But whereas I used to maybe teach 20 and at my really busiest times, maybe 30, but probably cut that in half. I love all my students very much right now. I don't teach anyone I don't like. That's a luxury that all teachers can probably relate with is, you know, teaching because you have to earn the money versus teaching because you love it. And I'm very fortunate right now. I love all of my students very much. So.
And do you think about your audience when you make the content, or you just kind of more reflect on what you care at the moment? Because I noticed that your content, I would say it was not a public pleaser in a good sense, you know? So for me, it didn't feel that you are maybe trying to follow too many trends. I felt that you were really talking about what interests you. And I thought, I just wanted to ask whether this was a conscious decision or, you know, have you thought about it?
Yeah, I have a lot. So there's a really fun video that I watched of this kid. He made, because the Barbie movie was the big thing. I haven't seen it, but that was a big thing, in at least in the U.S. A few months ago. And this
in Lithuania,
kid
too.
Everywhere, oh, okay.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
So, I haven't seen it as well.
Yeah. This kid came up with like a theme and variations on the Barbie theme and in like the style of Bach, I think, or something. I was like, man, that looks so cool. But I know how much time he must have spent making that. And writing it and then producing the video. And I've just told myself, like, I have to stay true to this mission that I'm on of helping as many people as I can and broadening that library. Like, my goal is before I die to have that library as huge as I can, because then the ideas that I've been so lucky to accumulate from three amazing teachers, Susan Dohlmeier, Sergey Babayan, and Logan Skelton, and then my wife and my discoveries in my practice, and then also discoveries from friends that I, fellow musicians, I just want to leave behind as much information as I can. And so that helps me to not follow trends, just this bigger picture. And I have never had exponential growth on my channel, ever. I've never had a month that, like, oh, I gained 20,000 followers this month because I posted this or that. And it's probably shooting myself in the foot financially, you know what I mean? Like, it's not the wisest thing to do financially. I have friends who absolutely hit it out of the park with videography courses and marketing courses and things like that that are just so brilliant. And I take a lot of their ideas to heart, but I don't do that fully because I feel like that's not really my brand. My brand's never been chasing trends. It's always been, we're going to explore this repertoire in depth together and technical exercises. And yes, if you look from a classical piano lens, I'm definitely a people pleaser. I've covered Clair de Lune. I've covered all the Chopin etudes. I've covered a Rachmaninoff concerto movement. If you look at the Mozart sonata, Beethoven sonatas. So I've definitely been a people pleaser that way in covering popular repertoire. I'm not digging up obscure repertoire to cover in these courses. And actually, I steer away from that because I've done that before at someone's request and it sold like one video. And I was like, that was not a very wise financial move. But at the same time, I try not to be a trendy sellout in the sense that, oh, I'm just doing this to provide for my family. I really try to do things. Yes, I do have to provide for my family. I wouldn't have all the time in the world to make these videos and not be paid for some of them in my paid courses. But I also try to keep that legacy as the first and foremost goal, to leave behind a great amount of information and instruction. So those are my thoughts on that. I know that was long-winded, but that's how I think about it.
Even though you say that you were a people pleaser, I still found that the things you talked about, technique, was so... It almost like only professional could understand that. I mean, that's a compliment, you know? So it was very, very, very nice to hear. And I guess another thing which I noticed a lot, the way you do your videos, there is so much kindness and relaxation in what you do. And I really miss that in our culture, in the classical music field.
Thank you.
And myself, we recently had a conversation with my friend. We both came from the same school, and she plays the flute and I play piano. And we noticed that we have somehow quite a negative approach, the way we think about classical music and, you know, the education we had. And I don't know whether this is because, you know, you've been educated in the West, and I obviously had a more Eastern type of education. And there is a lot of this kind of almost scarcity mindset and very black or white. So either you play a lot of concerts and, you know, all those parties where they happen and the people ask, so how many concerts do you play? So do you perform, you know, regularly? And
yeah,
what type of competitions have you done? And I just genuinely really liked the way you talk about music and about this profession. And yeah, I just wanted to hear your thoughts, whether you were always so positive towards it or you kind of had some epiphany.
Well, thank you. I appreciate those comments because that is my aim. I want my channel and courses and studio and concerts to always be like a safe, inspiring space. And the old school mentality that you hear from a lot of classical musicians of like, I'm going to break you down to nothing so I can rebuild you. I think that human beings can learn that way, but it takes a very special person to endure that well and come out positively. Not technically, you can probably with the most strict teacher, the most strict types of teachers or types of training, a lot of people come out playing amazingly well. But are they adjusted well as a human being? Because if they aren't and they give up on their music career, what was all of that for? And probably you're going to break them as a person too. I've noticed there's been a few people in my past who've been unusually cruel to me at competitions or with remarks that they've said. And that's not an effective way to learn. Now, I know that some personalities need to take a little beating to like get into shape and like get moving, you know, like it's not all sugarcoated. Like some of my students, I can yell at them, not like mean, like I'm mad at you, but I'm like, no, you've got to go back. Listen again, listen to that voicing. You've got to hear that. And, you know, we'll do it 10 or 20 times in a row, the same passage. But I'm not saying this is pathetic, you're a worthless person. And I think I have seen that type of commentary, and I just don't think it's a good way to learn. I've always joked around that the ultimate goal of my channel is to break down the ego of the classical music world, and I don't think that's working very well, but maybe a little bit. And so I think that my training, so I studied with my grandma for 4 or 5 years when I was growing up, so until age 9. And then I went to Susan Duhlmeier, who I still go see. She lives close by and she teaches our daughter now, but I still play for her. And, you know, after so many years, you think, oh, I'll know what Susan's going to say. And you don't. Like, she just continues to be so brilliant and offers so many fresh new musical ideas. And then the 20 or so lessons I had with Sergei Babayan, completely life-changing. He was intense in lessons. It was not an easy experience in those lessons and not always, you know, oh, this is so wonderful and, you know, inspiring. A lot of times it was, but sometimes you were getting beat down because he wanted to change you in that 60 minutes that you had. It was so precious. And after the lesson, he would always, you know, be so loving and warm. But when you were in the thick of it, sometimes it required harshness and directness. And Logan Skelton was very direct, but very loving, very much like Susan as well. So I've had mostly, and I would put Sergey Babayan into loving and warm as well. I would say Sergey's lessons were the most intense from a demanding perspective, probably because we had so little time together, because I would just take occasional lessons. And also, I think he's the greatest living pianist. So he demands that of himself. He's very much like Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan's, if you're a true musical geek, you may not know who Michael Jordan is. You know,
I know.
The greatest basketball player of all time. Oh, not you. I'm saying the audience. And, you know, he would say in his documentary, I loved that documentary that he made. And he said, I would never ask my teammates to do something I wouldn't be willing to do that I wasn't already doing. He said, I would lead by example. And his teammates said he was brutal and to be around because he was so demanding, but he elevated the entire team. And I think all three of my teachers are very much like that. And I think Sergey Babayan in particular is that type of force among elite pianists. So Daniel Trifonov, Dmitry Levkovich, Arseny Moon, Stanislav Kristenko, I think is his name, Zsolt Bognár. These are some of his more famous students. And I mean, it's really hard to find superior playing to any of those individuals. And when you're playing in a studio class and Daniel Trifonov walks in from a concert tour that he was just on, you're not going to be sloppy. You're not going to not take that extremely seriously. Or when you're watching a 14-year-old girl who flew from China to come play for Sergey and she plays the Opus 10 number 2, unlike anyone you've ever heard in your life, and you want to go kill yourself because you can't play that, the Chopin Etude Opus 10 number 2. It's that type of intensity. He said something in his academy. He had this Sergey Babayan Academy. I'm so sad it's over, but I was lucky enough to go to it twice. And he had a mission statement about it that said, we will work at a fever pitch going over the smallest details until we could find the firebird or something like that. He's very poetic with how he speaks. And working at a fever pitch, it really was like that. The lessons would often go late into the night. They would often go way, way longer than your hour that you were allotted. Sometimes we would work for 2 hours or sometimes more. And it was life-changing experiences at an intensity level I've never seen before. So I know this is long-winded again. I try to elaborate on podcasts because I have interviewed people and I know how painful it is. So if you need to
You're
stop
You're a wonderful
me,
guest, Josh. Yeah. Please elaborate.
But basically all I'm trying to say is I think that I've cultivated that kindness and safe space, hopefully, that's my goal at least, because of the amazing training I've had from these teachers. And also because I'm very religious and I do believe in God. And I think that kindness and giving and gratitude and spirituality all help the learning process rather than hinder it. Now, having said that, I did say earlier, there are some students that need a stern voice or, you know, a stern regimen to flourish. Not everyone responds the same, but I would say for the most part, people respond so much better to kindness and inspiration than they do fear or derogatory remarks or demeaning, especially demeaning remarks, because they can take it to affect their personality even rather than just their piano playing. So I think that's a dangerous place to dabble in. So I try not to do that.
And you mentioned a classical musician's ego. What did you mean by that?
I think there's a culture of elitism. And I think that that is actually it comes from a place that is good. We want to make the highest art that we can, the highest form of art that we can. We want every detail as polished as we can be. But that crosses over into perfectionism very quickly. And when you're always in this world of criticism, never-ending critiques, which is a good thing. I'm in that world too. Trust me, you need that to play at a high level. However, it can very easily, if you're not careful, transform into arrogance, condescension towards others, elitism, as I said before. So that's what I was saying of trying to break down the classical ego. And also this idea of we are a sharing community versus I'm going to keep this all a secret. I've taken lessons with certain teachers that feel very guarded about their ideas, and they will only share them if you're paying them money, or they'll only share them in a very safe, quiet environment, and you can't teach these ideas to anyone else. Please don't share these. It's like, what are you talking about? Why would I not share these if a student needs help or even on YouTube? And I think it's, again, they are instilled with fear when they're younger. They're afraid of judgment from others, negative judgment. And so they become elitist because I think it comes from a place of self-consciousness of they don't want to be judged. They don't want to be torn down. So they guard themselves, and thus it becomes elitist and a very closed off society. I mean, the instruction people get on my channel is largely from Susan Dohlmeier and Sergey Babayan and Logan Skelton, as well as a lot of my own ideas. But I always attribute those three as, you know, the fountain of most of my ideas and inspiration. You would be very hard pressed, unless you're quite an advanced pianist, to be able to get a lesson with any three of those. So amazing pedagogues. Not that they're elitist at all. It's just they don't have time. They're so busy, right? Teaching very advanced pianists who are wanting to make a career out of this. So an intermediate pianist working on, you know, a Bach invention or something can't get ideas from Logan Skelton or Sergey Babayan or Susan Dohlmeier if they can't reach them. And they get so many requests that I'm sure you can't reach them. So always, I mean, I think some people can, but that's what I wanted to share is I wanted to share some of these really amazing ideas. I know Tonebase is an online course platform. I'm friends with one of the producers there, Ben Loudy, nicest guy around. He's so funny as well. He does a great job with that. And that's a great source of hearing from masters. I try to share all that I've learned from masters because I think at the end of the day, we want this information to be shared. How great would it be to go take a lesson with Leschetizky? But we have a lot of writings from Leschetizky, thank heavens. But if we didn't, or Neuhaus, you know, The Art of Piano Playing, there's so many wonderful things in that book, or Chopin and His Pupils by Jean-Jacques Eigeldinger, or whatever his name is. I always forget the author's name. But hearing about Chopin's encounters with his students, we can kind of take a lesson with Chopin. It's pretty brilliant. Or master classes with Rubinstein are on YouTube. Thank heavens, those are shared. That's such a blessing. So that's the motivation behind all of this and trying to break down that ego and that secrecy.
And you mentioned that you had lessons with your grandma. So I understand that you come from a musical family, right?
Somewhat, yes. My grandma, yes, I took lessons. I come from a somewhat musical family. That's what I meant. So my grandma was a big self-starter. She would babysit for money. Back then, probably a quarter or something like that, you know, 25 cents. And she would take that and she would go to the music store and buy music, or she would use, she always called it her baby tending money. You know, she would have to babysit children for so many hours to pay for her piano lessons. I don't know if she bought her own piano or if her parents bought the piano for her. She was a very motivated woman. She studied jazz with Frank Sinatra's pianist, I believe, for Yeah, yeah, I think that's it. Frank Sinatra's pianist taught her for like 20 years, jazz lessons. She loved classical music. She never had any incredible music training. Now that we're talking, I don't know if I ever asked her when she was alive or even asked my mom who her teacher was. I know all of my other teachers' teachers, but I don't know who she studied with. But she never had high level training. But she was a good beginner and intermediate teacher, and early advanced. Once I got to a certain level, she said, "Really, you need to go see Susan Duhlmeier," who my mom had done a semester or two with in college. My mom got really sick with cancer. She recovered. But she had to drop out of her music program due to that. And so I did come from a musical family. My mom would practice with me a lot. Of course, I thought I knew more than her at 5 years old, even though she'd studied, as all five-year-olds probably do. I was probably bratty, but I was a hard worker as a kid. She said, you were neurotic, but at the same time, you were a good boy and you worked hard and we didn't ever have to worry about you being lazy. Like, you were such a perfectionist as a young kid. So I was lucky to grow up in that environment. My grandma was taught like 60 or 70 students. I don't know how that's possible. My mom taught piano for a time when I was really little, and now she's teaching again, which is really fun to see. She started up maybe 5 or 6 years ago teaching a lot of students. And all three of my siblings teach music lessons. So I'm the oldest, and I have two younger brothers and a sister. My sister has a master's degree in piano. My brother has a bachelor's degree in piano, and then my other brother has a master's in conducting, and he got another one in music education. So he's in charge of all the bands at a local high school. Really amazing at that job. He does a great job, and the kids absolutely love him. So it is a very musical family. My dad's family is completely the opposite. So they are stonemasons. In their family, like they put stone on churches or houses or fireplaces or whatever it might be. And so not in the arts per se, but it is still extremely artistic. He's definitely a craftsman, and I've drawn a lot of inspiration from my dad and his philosophy. And he was such a kind man. He grew up in a very stern household. It was work and church, and that's it. Like, that's all you do is go to church on Sundays, and then you work hard the rest of the week. He grew up on a farm, small farm, and then they also did stonemasonry. And he always told us, he said, "I want more for you guys than construction work." He said, "If you choose to do this trade, I'm more than happy to teach you how to do it, but I would like you to go to college. I'd like you to do that because I never really got the opportunity to do that." So he has, in one generation, changed the trajectory of our families. And who knows, maybe my kids will do stonemasonry, but it's pretty amazing that a stonemason raised four musicians. My mom, it's a little more understandable because she did take piano, but it's pretty incredible, I think, to see that change in the family occupation.
I think it's quite interesting for me because it seems that for you, taking a musical career was quite a natural thing, right? You started playing piano and then you kind of followed the path to the professional career, right? Have you ever thought about doing something else? Did you have that doubt where this is going and, what's going to happen?
I always knew that I would be a musician from the time I was 9 or 10. My parents had purchased Utah Symphony tickets, like season tickets for a couple of years. And I saw Ryan Brown. He and his siblings are the Five Browns. And they all went to Juilliard and are all very fine pianists and great people, just such nice human beings. And I saw him play with the Utah Symphony. I'm like, "I'm going to do that." And my parents are like, "Oh, really?" And I'm like, "Yes, I'm going to find a way to do that. That's what I want to do. This is what I want to do with my life." And they're like, "Okay." They knew I liked piano, but,
they said, 10, "Okay, well,
I think I was 8 or 9, I think, because I went to my mom said, "Okay, if you want to do this, you probably need to go to Susan. I don't even know if she'll accept you as a student, but we can try." And so my grandma said, "Yes, he needs to go see Susan." And so we auditioned. I still remember that audition. She had me do funny little things. I had a really good ear. I have perfect pitch. So she would have me say, like, you know, play something like that. She'd play a little something and say, "Play that back for me." And I'd say, "Okay." And I was like, I walked out of that. I was like, I don't think I did very good. Those were weird examples she was having me do. She had me play some technique and a couple pieces, but then she'd have me do all this ear training stuff. And she called back within a day or two and said, she was very formal. Knowing Susan now, I just laughed at how formal she was. But she did it probably for a good reason, because I took it so seriously. She said, "I will accept Josh into my studio if he works for 2.5 hours a day," or something like that. It was very specific time. And I said, "Okay, I'll do it." I was so desperate to take from her because I knew I wanted to do this. And so we worked really hard. She was so loving and amazing and very demanding as well, you know, for a young child, like, not in a mean or condescending way ever. Like, Susan is always so kind, but she was very detail-oriented. My grandma was amazing, but I could get by with little mistakes here or there, and she wouldn't really say much. And with Susan, it was just the opposite, and I was learning all these new things. And about a year... So I must have been 8 when I saw the Utah Symphony, because it was a year later. I think I was 9.5. I'd played with my first little teeny tiny orchestra. So it was just a little at a church. And Susan just hired 9 musicians to form a very small orchestra for her students, who were all playing, you know, Bach or Haydn or Mozart concertos. And I played and I loved it. I played pretty well. For being that age, I look back and I'm like, man, I wish I had a 9-year-old that could play the Mozart E flat. It was slow. But still, I look back and I'm like, wow, that's pretty good for a 9-year-old. And so I know there's 9-year-olds now that play, you know, like, way fast. But it was a great experience. And so we worked really hard, did a lot of competitions. Then when I was 12, I played with the Utah Symphony because I won a local competition and auditioned. So that I think was kind of the big trajectory point, is seeing that concert, playing with a little orchestra. And I think I played with maybe 1 or 2 other small orchestras for smaller competitions. But then to play with the Utah Symphony was like a lifelong dream up to that point. And I still haven't played with them again. It's pathetic. I live in Utah. I don't know why we haven't worked that out, but played with other orchestras. But anyway, that got it started. And then I started competing. I discovered a great love for Chopin. So I learned all the etudes, and, you know, some of them were very slow. You can listen to that recording. I recorded them when I was 14 and 15, but that was a huge project made me then want to do the National Chopin. And I got in when I was 16 and got absolutely destroyed. I was not nearly as good as most of the other pianists there, but that motivated me. I started winning other competitions, not something that big. And then it just kind of took that natural path. I went to college for this. And so the YouTube thing is, like, very weird to me that's become the main driver, the YouTube and, online courses, but I just knew I always wanted to be involved in music, and I'm very happy. Yes, I thought maybe I'd be playing bigger concerts at this point, or doing more prestigious things in the eyes of the world, but I find just as much satisfaction doing what I'm doing right now, because I still get to study great repertoire. I'm still trying to educate and pass that knowledge on to others, and it's really rewarding. So it's a strange career path, but I'm glad it happened the way it did. It's been really fun.
Well, Josh, most of the people, like most of the musicians, know you. So, you know, so maybe you say that you don't play at the prestigious, you know, massive venues, but most of the people I talk to, they know you. So I think that's pretty, pretty awesome, right?
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
And in one of the videos, please forgive me that I'm fishing for your words, but you said that you had some stupid mistakes in your career, and it was one of the I think last videos you did, and you were sharing about maybe was it on burnout and discouragement or hate and negativity? I can't remember now which one was it, but maybe you could share some of those shortcuts you could, you know, suggest to other musicians. And yeah.
Well, I don't remember the specific things. I've done a lot of dumb things in my life, but
career-wise, you know? Career-wise.
Yeah, I look back and I don't have a whole lot of regret over anything. I think having an open mind and being willing to explore non-traditional options is something that I think is a mistake that I see a lot of people make. It's important to realize that I'm going to win a competition and then get management and then live out my days as a concert pianist. First of all, that ship has kind of sailed in most areas. I mean, even can you name the third prize winner of the Arthur Rubinstein competition 3 times ago? Maybe you can, but most people couldn't. I can't. You can usually remember the winner, or if a friend competed, you know,
yeah.
Oh yeah, they won 4th. But, you know, these are huge competitions. These are some of the biggest in the world. Even the Tchaikovsky competition, do we know all the top 3 or 4 or 5 winners the last 4 or 5 competitions? I'm sure you could name quite a few. But again, it's a lot of people going after the exact same career path. So that in and of itself kind of ties back to what we were talking about earlier about egotism, elitism. It's a scarcity mentality baked into our career of like, if he gets a concert or she gets a concert, that's one less concert that I get to play. And I don't like that mentality. I like much more of like, just create your own opportunities. If you want to play a concert, book a venue that you like that's inexpensive and invite a bunch of people. First of all, I will say this. When I was 16 years old, my dad said, okay, if you're going to get a job, you can work with me as a stonemason, or you can start your own business. But I don't want you working at McDonald's because not that there's anything wrong with that, but he's like, I want more for you than that. He's like, you got to use your music if you're going to do that, or you can come work and help me with my business. And I said, oh gosh, I hate working construction, because I didn't lay any of the stone. I was like mixing the cement and moving all the rocks from the truck into the house. It was just hard, hard labor. So I said, fine, Dad, I'm starting my own business. And he said, well, good. And so I asked some neighbors if they knew anyone that needed a piano teacher. And my mom had a friend who had 2 kids that wanted lessons. And so I asked them after their 1st or 2nd lesson, I said, you know, if you're liking these lessons and you know anyone else that might want lessons. And the lady, she was awesome. She said, oh, yes, let's have you come and play for my church congregation, and I'll invite all the youth, like the young kids that are in the ward and their parents, to come hear you play, because we want to hear you play a concert anyway, like, because we love your playing. But then at the end, you can say, I'm taking on new students. And she's like, and it'll be a very easy sell because you drive to our house for the lessons. Most parents love that. It's like almost like just expensive babysitting, you know, like because I was charging like $10 for a lesson, you know, and I would drive to your house too. I didn't charge any extra.
The best teacher ever.
Yeah. So, but I was only 16. I didn't have a lot of experience, so I didn't want to charge a lot. And within that night, after that, I had like a full studio. I had like 10 or 12 new students. And I was like, okay, Dad, I quit. And he laughed and he's like, well, good for you. And ever since then, I've loved teaching. But I thought, getting back to scarcity mentality and career paths, you know, that was a very easy way to break into providing for myself as a musician, saving up for college and things like that, paying for all my own gas money. My parents were very nice. They bought a car that I could use to take those lessons. I know a lot of people are not that fortunate to have that luxury, but my parents were always supportive. They really are the reason. I think my parents, Susan and Lindsay, were the main drivers of all the success in my life. And then Sergey and Logan added greatly to that. But I think those three, those four people, my two parents, Susan and Lindsay, my wife, were the initial trajectory to my success throughout my life. So it's been a weird career, but I would just challenge everyone to not just think of that one career path. For instance, I have a student who I'm very worried about right now. He's a brilliant player. He's the most talented student I've ever taught by quite a wide margin. He can do some things I can't do. Like he can play the Schubert Liszt Earl King faster than Kissin. You know, I mean, it's just amazing. Like his repeated octaves or his scalar passage work is so clean and beautiful. And just, I mean, it sounds like an old Chopin recording, you know. I'm just like, holy smokes, like of Courtauld or something, very polished, Ignaz Friedman. It's really high, high level. But I worry about him because if he's like, I just want to be a concert pianist. That's all I want to do. And I'm like, okay, what are your other interests? He's like, I don't have other interests, but he does. He has a fascination with music history. Whenever we're working on a piece together, I'm like, teach me about this. I don't remember my music history classes. Teach me about this Beethoven sonata or this Chopin etude. Where was Chopin at this point in his life? And he usually can, with pinpoint accuracy, say he was right here at this time. He had just written this piece. He was about to write this piece. And it was really hard for him at this point because it's amazing how smart he is. So I say, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to go for the concert pianist route because that's your main thing. But I want you to get a secondary study in musicology and you can support yourself with your concerts while teaching music history. And he's like, wow, I like that idea. So there's a lot of paths that don't involve just being a professor that people can take. And I think that's important to keep that open mind about a music career, that you can still get great satisfaction from your life and your career, even if it's not what you originally planned. If you want to be a concert pianist, I felt kind of like a failure for a while, like I never really made it. You know what I mean? I'm not playing with huge orchestras. I'm not, you know, booking very expensive gigs or at the most prestigious halls. And it's taken me having kids and being at home with my kids and seeing other concert pianists who have kids who hardly ever see them because they're always on the road to say, you know, I always wanted to have kids. But it took me to this point in my 30s to realize, wow, I'm actually glad I don't have that career. And a lot of people listening are like, uh-huh, sure, nice justification that you failed. But I'm being serious when I say that. I would be so sad. I don't enjoy traveling for work very much anymore. This is why I love the results of COVID with Zoom. Like I hated COVID. Everyone hated it. But I love that everyone got online, something I'd been doing since 2012, and a lot of people made fun of me for it. And then they're all desperately asking me, teach us what you're doing. And so I was like, yeah, sure. And so, but I love that opportunity I have as a musician working from home most times. I still travel for concerts occasionally, but I'm doing most of my teaching here in the studio online. I teach students all around the world. I have two students that live locally and I have, you know, maybe 12 to 15 students. Some of them I teach every other week. So I usually only teach about 10 lessons a week and I'm making all these videos. So it's taken a long time for me to be okay with how things turned out. I've always enjoyed it. I've always had fun doing what I've been doing, but to mentally and psychologically be okay, like, hey, you didn't make it as a giant pianist, you know, playing, recording for Deutsche Grammophon and doing all these things. And never say never. Bob Ayan just got a huge contract with Deutsche Grammophon and he's playing more concerts than he probably ever has. But I don't think I'm nearly as good as he is. So I'm not saying that to be arrogant. I'm saying that from a point of humility. But I'm quite happy with how things turned out. I feel very grateful. And I think that's what we need to search for as musicians.
you talked about this moment when you felt maybe as a failure. How did you overcome this? Or you just kind of let it go and, you know, you just let the time pass and kind of to solve it on its own?
Yeah, I would just sit back and question and say, okay, you could be playing a big concert. Like, let's say that I won some of these huge competitions. I was never an accurate enough player. I'm a pretty polished player, but I was never at the level of like Eric Liu. Like, I competed against him. I won fifth at the National Chopin. He won first. He doesn't miss notes. I mean, he does, but it's a rarity. Whereas I might miss a note or two, you know, in a performance of a piece. I think most people do. It's rare to have that level of perfection that a lot of these pianists do that are winning the competitions, you know. They're also very musical. Eric plays beautifully. I'm not just saying he's, you know, a technical machine. He's a great human being and a beautiful player, but he's got it all. I didn't have quite that level. And maybe if I worked 10 hours a day, I could have been at that level. I'll never know because I didn't want to do that. I wanted to teach and I wanted to go to school, you know, for music. And anyway, getting a little off topic, but I think that people have to come. I would just look at it logically, like, hey, are you enjoying what you're doing? Yes. Are you still playing great repertoire? Yes, I am. Are you still learning? Yes. Are you enriching the lives of others? Yes. So it's just a different form of performing. It's not like I've failed. I'm not doing anything. I worked my whole life to be a musician and now I'm not. I'm a, you know, dental hygienist or something totally different. Not, I mean, I love my dental hygienist. There's nothing, I'm not putting that down. I'm saying I haven't left the field of music. I think that for me would be the ultimate failure is leaving this profession because I love it so much. I've found other ways to make it work. And I think most people do find ways to make it work. Even if you're just teaching a bunch of students out of your home or if you are accompanying a lot, there's still so much joy to be had in jobs like that or doing a creative thing like developing a music app. I know a lot of people have done much more techie, creative things that have blessed the lives of other musicians. So I think when you have that perspective of, am I still making great music? Am I still blessing the lives of others through music? It opens up a lot of possibilities to where you don't feel like a failure anymore. You can feel a lot of fulfillment in those endeavors.
I'm thinking maybe if we would hear more about people doing other things, you know, I feel like our education is very focusing on this one linear path. And this is why we feel very often that we didn't make it, but because there was only one path suggested.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think there's a good reason for that. We do have to focus heavily on perfecting and honing our craft as much as we can in those precious years at school and in a conservatory or university or private studies with a professor. That's what you have to focus on, because if you don't reach a high level, how are you going to educate others about it? But you're right in the sense that music school does not prepare you for a successful career in music unless you are going the professor route. Then it prepares you beautifully because, hey, I took these classes and now I'm teaching them. And even the career development classes, I loved those classes. Those were good. You know, build a website, make a press kit, which is kind of an outdated thing these days. You still need a press kit, but you can do it all digitally. Those were more interesting from a career standpoint, but still the teachers teaching those classes often were steeped in the traditional route. They weren't, you know, someone who was an entrepreneur who's carved their own pathway teaching the class. And it's hard because people can say, how did you do it, Josh? It's like, I kind of formed my own path. And somebody can copy me, you know, and do exactly what I'm doing, fine. But finding your own path is hard, but it's also very rewarding. So I don't think there would be a class that could prepare us for that, in other words. Like, I don't know if there is such a thing as like, oh, if we changed our educational system, we would prepare them so much better for careers. I mean, yeah, maybe a few more career development type classes would help, but if you truly want to be an entrepreneur and carve your own path, it's going to take personal creativity. There is nobody that can tell you exactly what to do with your life. You have to choose.